This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia warns of a real danger of a World War III as tensions escalate between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. North Korea's leader pledges to strengthen the country's nuclear weapons program during a high-profile military parade in Pyongyang. And a senior Palestinian politician says Palestinians want not only an end to the occupation, but also the overthrow of the apartheid and racist Israeli regime. Hello and welcome to World News. The Russian foreign minister has warned of, quote, a real danger of a World War III as tensions escalate between Moscow and the West over the war in Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov said the danger of a World War III is serious and cannot be underestimated. His remarks came as the U.S. and its European allies are supplying weapons to help Ukraine resist the Russian offensive. Moscow has warned the West of unpredictable consequences if arming Ukraine continues. Lavrov said peace talks with Ukraine will continue, expressing confidence that the conflict will end with the signing of an accord. He criticized Kiev's approach to the talks, saying goodwill has its limits and will not help negotiations if it's not reciprocal. Lavrov accused Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of pretending to negotiate. He said Zelensky is a good actor, but there are, quote, 1,000 contradictions in his remarks. Russia says its missiles have destroyed 6 railway facilities that were used to deliver foreign weapons to Ukrainian forces in the Donbas region. The Russian Defense Ministry says its forces also destroyed an arms depot in the Donetsk region, among various other military installations on Monday. According to Ukrainian officials, Russian airstrikes hit railway stations in the country's western and central regions, killing at least 5 people and injuring 18 others. Ukraine's military command says Moscow was trying to bomb railway infrastructures in order to disrupt arms supplies from foreign countries. Meanwhile, Russia says it has pounded 56 Ukrainian military facilities overnight. Moscow also reports that the Ukrainian army has shelled a village in Russia's Belgorod region. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, insists providing deadly weapons to Ukraine is the right thing to do. However, there is growing opposition to the West's policy in this regard over concerns that it will prolong the ongoing conflict with Russia. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU and its Western allies continue to pour hundreds of millions of euro worth of deadly weapons into Ukraine. Speaking in India on Monday, the head of the bloc's executive arm, Ursula von der Leyen, defended this policy.
Our response to Russia's aggression today will decide the future of both the international system and the global economy.
Just last week in the European Parliament, a number of legislators questioned the wisdom of pumping lethal weapons into Ukraine.
If there is a ceasefire, who's going to disarm those individuals who are receiving these arms? We know how weapons sent to fight al-Assad in Syria ended up being used for attacks in other countries.
Also, it's clear many EU citizens are against the enormous militarization of Ukraine by the West.
If you send weapons, maybe you will encourage the conflict.
We all must hope the world need peace.
I think the peace is the best way.
Weapon is not the answer to nothing.
Poverty is on the rise in the EU, and so campaigners say the huge amounts of money being spent on providing weapons for the conflict could be better spent.
People are faced with the COVID crisis, you know, with energy crisis, you know, the bills of people are tripled or even quadrupled. So it's something ununderstandable.
But the European Commission insists the arming of Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict.
The war can stop today if Russia decides that it should stop. It has nothing to do with the arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine is only defending itself.
However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Otherwise, they suggest, there is no way of ending this conflict. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
North Korea working on plans to boost its nuclear force at high speed in preparation for future crises. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, says nuclear weapons are a symbol of national power and should be diversified. According to Kim, North Korea needs to be prepared to deploy its nuclear deterrence anytime, noting that such weapons are primarily aimed at warding off foreign threats. He said nukes could be deployed in case North Korea's fundamental interests were attacked. Kim made the remarks at a military parade on the occasion of the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. The parade featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. And China begins mass testing for the coronavirus in its capital to avoid a lockdown similar to the one that has shut down Shanghai for a month. Authorities are hoping that their campaign to test 75% of Beijing's 22 million population will root out the spread. Meantime, residents are stocking up on food and supplies in preparation for possible localized lockdowns. This is fueled by frustration among residents of Shanghai, where 25 million people are confined to their homes. Shanghai authorities waited for about a month and more than 1,000 infections before launching citywide testing. The city now has hundreds of thousands of cases and reported 52 deaths on Tuesday. Amid ongoing Israeli aggression against Al-Aqsa in occupied Al-Quds, hundreds of activists have taken to London streets to mark annual Quds Day. The day has been a target of pro-Israel lobby attempts to ban the protest. Despite this, London organizers have succeeded in keeping the event going, preserving the legacy of Imam Khomeini. Robert Carter reports from London.
Hundreds of protesters flocked to central London on Sunday to honor the call of International Quds Day. The annual event, held on the last weekend of Ramadan, was initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979 to express solidarity for Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism.
Israeli aggression against Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan has become so regular that it's turned almost regrettably into an annual tradition. That's why tensions are so high this year, as continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is ongoing even at the time of this recording.
Due to its popularity, many attempts have been made by pro-Israel groups to ban the rally, with critics citing anti-Semitism accusations. Event supporters, however, rubbished these claims.
The Al-Quds demonstration is in support of the Palestinians in their fight against Zionism. Zionism is a totally different philosophy to Judaism. Zionism is a false, secular philosophy. Judaism is an age-old religion. Being against Zionism is being against falsehood. Nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all.
The very fact that the protest movement is being criminalized and there are efforts to ban it, I think that speaks volumes. They don't want concepts of resistance to be spoken about. Like, I'm not sure if you realize in some of the protests, there's an emphasis on 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation no more, but not an emphasis on 5, 6, 7, 8, Israel is a terrorist state, right? It's like, we have solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. We call out their victimhood, but we also target the aggressor.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound has been at the center of weeks of heightened Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers since the beginning of the Holy Month. With at least 19 Palestinians killed so far, fears remain high that another full-scale war could break out as Gaza's resistance threatens greater retaliation. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories must end to make way for resolution of the conflict in Palestine. Majid Takht Ravanchi said full recognition of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people is also a prerequisite for resolution of the conflict. Iran's UN ambassador said the regime's atrocities against Palestinians amount to war crimes under international law. He criticized the current stance of the UN Security Council and Israel's aggressions, saying it has only emboldened the regime to perpetuate its occupation and atrocities. Takht Ravanchi called on the Security Council to hold Israel accountable through all legal means at its disposal. The Iranian envoy condemned the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying any desecration of Muslims' holy sites should not be tolerated. A senior Palestinian politician says the so-called two-state solution to Palestinian issue has failed and is not accepted by Palestinians anymore. Mustafa Barghouti, the general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, was speaking with Iran's Al-Olam Arabic News Network. He said at present, Palestinians not only want an end to the occupation, but also the overthrow of the apartheid and racist Israeli regime across the occupied territories. Barghouti said the cost of occupation and racism is too high for Israel to be able to pay. He added that the resistance has tipped the balance of power in favor of Palestinians and has spread fear and confusion among Zionists. Barghouti emphasized that Palestinians must follow the path of resistance, not negotiations with Israel. He also criticized global inaction on Israeli crimes, asking how so many sanctions can be imposed on Russia in just a few weeks, while Israel has remained unpunished during the last 74 years. Yemen says it's released the crew of a cargo ship called Rabi, which belongs to the United Arab Emirates and was seized in January. The spokesman of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement said the vessel's 11-member crew was released through an agreement facilitated by Oman. Mohammed Abdel Salam said a detained British man was also released without providing more details. The Emirati vessel was captured in the Red Sea on January the 3rd. The Saudi-led coalition, which launched the war on Yemen in 2015, claims the ship carried medical equipment. Yemen says it was transporting military hardware. Earlier on Sunday, Yemen made a new offer to the coalition via the UN for the exchange of 200 prisoners from each warring side. Yemenis have held a conference in the capital Sana'a to support the Palestinian cause and to call on the free people of the world to stand by the Palestinian people, especially amid the ongoing Israeli crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washili reports from Sana'a.
Amid the Israeli escalation against Palestinians, Yemenis have held a conference called Palestine, the Central Cause of the Nation, in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Senior officials have participated in the event to express their support for Palestinians.
The conference was held in Sana'a, the capital, which represents a symbol of a steadfastness and resistance in the face of those who normalize relations with the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni people are a living example of free people, as the central issue for us is Palestine. If Yemen was still ruled by the previous regime, it would have been portrayed as having normalized relations with Israel. But praise be to God, the Yemeni people have been liberated.
Organizers said this conference is a preparation for the celebration of the International Quds Day, as Yemenis will fill the streets of Sana'a to prove their solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
This conference comes as part of preparations for marking Quds Day, which will be unprecedented this year, as the Yemeni people will come out to confirm that Palestine is the central issue of the nation. The message that we are sending through this conference is that the Yemeni people, with all their sects and components, insist that the Palestinian cause is the basis for the solution to all the problems facing the Islamic nation.
During the conference, the president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, called for forming official and popular funds to support the Palestinian people and returning the Palestinian issue to the curricula to emphasize its importance for all generations. Despite everything that is currently happening in the world and the catastrophic situation in the country, people who say they will never forget the Palestinian cause, they say it is the time for the free people of the world to prove their support for Palestinians against ongoing Israeli crimes.
Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the marijuana business has turned into a flourishing trade in Canada, with more shops opening each day. This has raised concerns about the damaging impact the widespread use of drugs could have on society.
In a recent report by the New York Times, Canada's main city of Toronto was described as the Wild West of marijuana shops. According to the report, Ontario's provincial government permitted the shops by emergency order to keep operating during the COVID-19 pandemic, even during lockdowns. During this period, to the investors' delight, shares in the stocks of licensed medical marijuana growers in Canada have multiplied in price. However, the marijuana business was already expected to flourish, even before the pandemic started in 2019 and right after Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to fulfill a campaign promise, introduced legislation to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Canada. The prospects look good. Eventually, the Government of Canada legalized cannabis for recreational use on October 17, 2018. The Cannabis Act creates a legal and regulatory framework for controlling the production, distribution, sale, and possession of cannabis in Canada. Canada is now the second nation after Uruguay to completely legalize marijuana as a consumer product, in an effort to extinguish the criminal trade and keep the substance out of the hands of youth by regulating the market. However, growing, importing, exporting, or selling marijuana, particularly to minors, outside licensed channels, remain a serious crime. Meanwhile, critics of the cannabis law highlight the damaging impact to society of the widespread use of the drugs. When the use of cannabis becomes more widespread, the drug can also have downsides, including acute injuries and illnesses. In some cases, marijuana could lead to cyclical vomiting syndrome, a condition characterized by vomiting and severe abdominal pain. And also, those who use cannabis are more prone to mental illnesses.
A group of independent UN experts says the U.S. is making life worse for Afghan women by freezing billions of dollars worth of the country's assets. The statement was jointly issued by 14 experts appointed by the Geneva-based Human Rights Council. They said countries, including the U.S., are obliged by international laws to ensure that their activities do not result in rights violations. The experts noted that they have relayed their concerns and recommendations to Washington, but have not yet received a reply. The U.N. experts also blamed the ruling Taliban's code widening gender-based discrimination for deteriorating women's rights. They said the current humanitarian crisis, where 23 million are relying on food aid, is having a disproportionate impact on women and children.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, In no month, the faithful have been recommended to pray and supplicate as in the blessed month of Ramadan. Interestingly, in many of the prayers of this month, a special attention has been paid to the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. The aspirations and ideals of mankind are highly bolded in these prayers and supplications. These ideals will materialize only in the time of Imam Mahdi's rule, and he's the person who will lead humanity towards that ideal society. According to the Islamic narrations, Ramadan is the best month for praying, and the best prayer is to ask God to expedite the reappearance of the Savior of mankind. One of the famous supplications and prayers that the faithful are recommended to recite in the nights of Ramadan is Dua-e-Iftitah, or prayer of opening. Opening here means removal of sorrows and end of miseries and solving all problems. The prayer begins with praising God and celebrating His attributes, glorifying His mercy and seeking His forgiveness. Then God is praised and thanked for guiding us through the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors. The Prophet of Islam, his daughter Fatima, and the 12 Imams are mentioned and greeted in the prayer by name. And the prayer ends with complaining God for the absence of Imam Mahdi and beseeching God to terminate the period of occultation and hasten the Imam's reappearance. In part of the prayer we say, O God, indeed we are inclined toward you in the noble government of Imam Mahdi, whereby you will dignify Islam and its people, and will abase hypocrisy and its people, and will make us among the callers to your obedience and leaders to your way, and through it grant us the nobility of the world and the hereafter. We hope that God will answer the prayers of the faithful across the world and will shorten the period of Imam Mahdi's stay in occultation, as he is the last savior of mankind. He is the man who will obliterate injustice and tyranny and will spread justice everywhere. One of the beautiful traditions in Islam is relation with relatives. Relations with relatives is called Sile-i Rahim. It means visiting each other and helping one another in problems. This tradition is very effective in the life of this world and the hereafter. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in his famous sermon on the blessed month of Ramadan, in this month, have relation with relatives. He who keeps relation with relatives, God will send his mercy to him of the day of judgment. While he who severs relation with relatives, God will keep his mercy away from him. According to the narrations, relatives are both those who share a common ancestor with us or those whom we have got linked through marriage. Relation with relatives is an obligatory act, and the nearest relatives are parents and siblings. Now the question is, how can we sever relations with relatives who are bad-tempered, corrupt, or even faithless? Our divine leaders tell us that we cannot sever relations with these relatives. However, the kind of relation changes according to the conditions. For instance, we can decrease commutations or be in contact with them through telephone, email, or so on. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, nothing severs the right of relatives. Then, if they are brothers in faith, they have two rights. One is the right of relative and the other is the right of Islam. Relation with relatives has a broad meaning. It includes being kind to them, trying to solve their problems, helping them with their debts, bidding what is good and forbidding what is evil, visiting their patients, respecting them, etc. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, have relation with relatives. Do good to your brothers, even if with good greetings and replying their greetings. Elsewhere, the Imam says, have relation with your relatives even with a sip of water. It has been mentioned in Islamic narrations that relation with relatives has many positive impacts. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, relation with relatives makes the temperament good, makes the hand generous, purifies the soul, increases sustenance, and delays the hour of death. It makes the reckoning of the Day of Judgment easy and prevents man from bad death. On the contrary, the divine leaders have warned against the effects of severing relation with relatives. A man asked the Prophet, what is the most hated act with God? The Messenger of Mercy answered, associating partner with God. The man asked, and after that, the Prophet said, he who severs relation with relatives. One of the things that create many problems for the digestive system is eating in hurry. Thus, we should avoid eating hurriedly in iftar or sahari, that is pre-dawn meal. We should have the iftar and sahari calmly and slowly. This way, the digestive system will metabolize the food and drink better. We should avoid stress, anxiety, fear, and excitement while eating. The blessed month of Ramadan is a good opportunity to consume healthy oils. Olive oil is the one of the best oils which have been highly recommended by physicians and specialists of nutrition. Sesame oil is also very good. Specialists advise us to consume both animal and plant proteins. Yet, animal protein is absorbed 15% better. However, seeds like lentil, peas, and beans are good if we do not use them extravagantly.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The past week has seen repeated Zionist incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Worshippers have been refused access, locked in, assaulted, attacked, and arrested. The Jewish settlers who attacked worshippers and desecrated Al-Aqsa were protected by armed Zionist police and military personnel. And these outrages are occurring during the holy month of Ramadan, when Muslims traditionally flock to Al-Aqsa to pray. So in today's programme, we'll examine the response of the Palestinians to these events and look in depth at the state of the resistance to the Zionist colony. We'll also highlight the importance of Al-Quds Day, which is traditionally marked on the last Friday of Ramadan and is an important fixture in the international calendar of resistance. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on how Palestine resists occupation.
The Palestinians have faced over 100 years of Zionist settler colonialism and resisted every step of the way. They have shown endless courage and fortitude and written their history in their blood, sweat and tears. But they have never been alone. From the 1936 rebellion against the British to today, the Palestinians have always had the hearts of millions. The Zionist entity has attacked every country it is near and has reportedly carried out assassinations in at least 18 different states. On a popular level, Zionism is a pariah. The arrogance of the Zionist entity is a fragile veneer over its increasing vulnerability. UN Resolution 3246 asserts the Palestinians have the right to liberate themselves from foreign occupation through armed struggle, and governments representing the vast majority of humanity do not prescribe the Palestinian resistance. Today, resistance forces are more united than ever. Over 1 million Palestinians live within the 1948 Zionist entity. During the 2021 Battle of Saif al-Quds, they went on strike for 1 day, causing losses to the settler economy of over $40 million. On the same day, almost 1,000 Palestinian bus drivers went on strike, leading to the cancellation of 300 journeys in the entity. At the same time, resistance from Gaza had closed Ben-Gurion Airport in occupied Jaffa. The situation became so desperate for the apartheid regime that the mayor of Lod called for the mobilization of the occupation forces in the city. Settlers abandoned their homes as the municipality completely lost control. Overall, the resistance caused the currency of the entity to fall and the economy to stagger. The other side of the equation has seen for the very first time the honorable resistance in Gaza, launching Russian-made 9K-32 Stellar to surface-to-air missiles at occupier fighter jets. Helicopters and drones are especially vulnerable. How long before one is caught and tumbles down into Gaza, the home of heroes? Even the head of Israeli intelligence has no security. Mossad chief David Barnea had his phone hacked and details of his taxes and wages published on Telegram by a group said to be close to the resistance. In the very same month, the websites of the Ministry of the Interior and others of the Israeli regime were hacked and taken down. It has also been reported that the Islamic Republic of Iran has sent pictures to the Israeli regime through intermediaries of the locations for all biological, chemical, and nuclear weapon storages that will be struck at the first military clash with the entity. The same account which reported this previously leaked the locations for all Israeli military bases across occupied Palestine. The resistance is closer than you think. The spider's web is more fragile than you could ever imagine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Nora Barrows-Friedman. Nora is a staff writer and associate editor of the Electronic Intifada, the leading Palestine solidarity news website. She's also the author of In Our Power, US Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. She joins us from California and recorded her contribution earlier. Welcome to the show. We started by asking Nora about the significance of the Al-Kurd family who were active participants in the events in Sheikh Jarrah and what that says about the new Palestinian resistance.
I think that's a wonderful question. And I feel like the convergence of so many factors here. We have, youth have always been at the forefront of uprisings and rebellions and resistance in Palestine. But I think now with the advent of social media and the ability for, young activists like Mohammed and Muna to be able to just, flip on their phone and live stream to the entire world what's happening on the ground right in front of their eyes, right in their backyard, I think has made solidarity with Palestinians much broader and has really, I think, informed especially young people who see themselves in people like Mohammed and Muna and so many other youth in Palestine who are, articulating the violence, the everyday violence of occupation and are able to connect with other struggles against colonialism and imperialism and racism around the world.
David, how important do you think social media is in the battle for international opinion to secure the liberation of Palestine?
It's a two-part answer to this. Social media is important, and you can see the importance of social media by the fact that the Israelis spend a lot of time trying to monitor it and censor it. So that, for example, one of the members of the Facebook oversight board, Emmy Parmar, is a former Israeli intelligence operative who was in charge of the cyber security unit in the Israeli government, which was involved in taking down thousands and thousands of pages run by Palestinians and supporters of the Palestinians when she was in the government. And now she helps Facebook to decide which pages should be allowed to stay there, and indeed helps to decide which Palestinians should be arrested for incitement for things they've put on Facebook. So clearly the Israelis think that social media is important. But there's another sense in which social media isn't everything. It's not the whole of the resistance. The resistance has a cutting edge, and that is armed opposition to the settler entity. And it is that and the resistance, the daily resistance of the Palestinian people, which will provide the cutting edge for the liberation of Palestine. And at that stage, social media will play catch up and will be following the victories of the liberation as it comes.
Well, we also asked Nora for her assessment of the positive developments that's come out of the confrontation between the Zionists and the resistance in May 2021.
It's always hard to talk about positive developments against the backdrop of, a vicious Israeli military assault, which lasted 11 days and killed, more than 250 Palestinians, including dozens of children, flattened entire apartment buildings, media offices, critical infrastructure. What we did see at the same time was an expansion of kind of this pan-Palestinian inside the inside Palestine and in the diaspora, really rising up in unison. We saw, people have called it the Unity Intifada that was sparked last May because of the violence that Israel meted out. And we saw Palestinians inside 48, inside historic Palestine, Palestinian citizens of Israel, rising up alongside Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. And in the diaspora, we saw, marches to the boundary between Lebanon and present-day Israel and in Jordan as well. as well as, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, Palestinians, you know, people from every sort of background, you know, across the world, in Europe and in the US. And so I think that has ignited more of a momentum of global solidarity with Palestine and Palestinians and the struggle for liberation. And I think, you know, that has once again, you know, sparked real direct actions. We've seen these incredible direct actions in the UK by people with Palestine Action who are literally putting their bodies on the line to shut down weapons factories, Israeli weapons factories. And I think that is you know, far overdue, those kinds of actions. And I think they're getting wonderful results, you know, real palpable material results because of Israel's, you know, barbaric and serial attacks on Palestine.
David, just picking up with this idea of a unity intifada, I mean, do you think there's a sort of axis of resistance emerging now?
I think the notion of unity intifada is an interesting and useful one, and we've see that from last May, but also in the contemporary events, people probably will have seen on social media that when the Israelis tried to arrest the father of one of the people they killed the other week, there was a resistance movement which blocked all access to Jenin and stopped the Israelis from arresting this guy. And that involved all of the different armed factions as well as non-armed factions in Palestine. So Saraya, the Qassam Brigades, the PFLP, and indeed Palestinian Islamic Jihad. That's them all acting in unison. So that's a real indication of a unity in the resistance. And even some of the Fatah armed units have been joining in with this, which is quite extraordinary given Fatah is largely collaborating with the Israelis. So there's a level of unity there which is new, and which is extremely positive, I think, for the resistance. But when you use the phrase axis of resistance, I'm not sure people in the West really are familiar with that term. It doesn't mean necessarily an axis of resistance inside Palestine. It means, yes, the resistance in Palestine, all the different factions, but also the resistance to Western interests around about Palestine. So it means the Iranians, it means Syria, it means Hezbollah, in Lebanon. It means several of the units and the movements in Iraq, and indeed, of course, Ansar Allah in Yemen, fighting the Saudis and the UAE and the Americans in Yemen. So that is a self-conscious sense of a unity between all sorts of different movements, not just self-conscious, but a practical unity. So that last May, for example, there was a situation room in Beirut where the Palestinians, the Iranians, Hezbollah and others were actually planning collectively what the resistance would do. Now that's a game changer for the ability of the Zionists to resist the liberation movement. And that's what we see now in the all these leaks that have been coming about Israeli intelligence, about the sites of military bases. We see the ability of the Zionists to resist a possible uprising is becoming narrower and narrower, and that's what the axis of resistance means.
Well, lastly, we asked Nora for her thoughts on what's happening at Al-Aqsa right now and the implications of these events.
Yeah, once again, we see Israel violently provoking Palestinian worshippers during Ramadan. You know, and it kind of illustrates how empowered the fanatical ultra-right-wing settler movement has been in the last few years, you know, headed by the Israeli member of Knesset, Itamar Ben-Gvir, this latest kind of settler incursion and plans to, you know, to provoke Palestinians at Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock has been just... I mean, you know, every once in a while, like I am shocked at the level of absolute racist fanaticism that we see But it's not surprising. You know, I'm like, how can this still be happening? Where just today, we saw mobs of young Israeli settler, you know, right wing Zionist nationalist youth chanting death to Arabs, and, you know, promising a second Nakba, and being completely egged on and emboldened by politicians in Israel and these like heads of the most fanatical settler movements that we've seen. It is all designed to once again, to make life completely miserable for Palestinians. I mean, the Zionist plan has always been to push Palestinians to the brink so that they just give up and leave. Whether it's what Ilan Pappe calls a slow motion genocide, right? You have violent attacks where people are literally being killed. That's literal, you know, violent genocide. And then you have the kind of, slow motion incremental genocide, which is, the ethnic cleansing operations of making life so miserable that Palestinians just get up and leave. And, you know, we've seen that over the last few years in Sheikh Jarrah, where Palestinians are literally being kicked out of their homes so that settlers can take them. It's not just happening in Sheikh Jarrah. Of course, it's happening all over Palestine, inside the West Bank and inside 48. I hope that it won't escalate into another war, because that always means more death and destruction for Palestinians. But Israel is not known for their restraint or their diplomacy or their adherence to international laws or certainly responsibilities toward justice. I think we're just watching it very closely.
David, these Al-Aqsa incursions, they seem pretty chaotic and ill-planned. I mean, are they really spontaneous, do you think? Or is it part of a wider strategy?
This is a strategy which goes back 100 years or more. I mean, in 1929, for example, there was a huge incident in Hebron, which was provoked by attempts by radical Zionists to try and access Al-Aqsa. And this has been going on since then. So, yes, it's a strategy, back 100 years at least. But, of course, more recently, there is a strategy to completely undermine the Al-Aqsa Mosque itself. There are this archaeological digging, alleged archaeological digging, underneath the Western Wall and under Al-Aqsa. And there are these incursions which are planned by settler groups. You may have seen on social media some of the photographs of Orthodox settlers with young goats in plastic bags, trying to smuggle them into Al-Aqsa to sacrifice them on Passover. Now, that's a plan which comes from something called the Temple Institute, which is based just nearby and is funded by the Israeli government. And it wants to replace Al-Aqsa altogether with what's called the Third Temple. So this is an actual attempt that's been going on for over 100 years to simply remove Al-Aqsa, one of the key sites in Islam and in the religion.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment, and we've got another report now on the history and contemporary significance of Al-Quds Day, which is traditionally marked on the last Friday of Ramadan.
Al-Quds Day is a global day of protest, of solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. It's commemorated on the last Friday of Ramadan. First announced by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 and first celebrated in 1980, Quds Day is a declaration of hostility to Zionism. Quds is known as Jerusalem by the Zionists. In Iran, it is routine for millions to attend Quds Day demonstrations in Tehran and other cities such as Qom. Hezbollah organizes large demonstrations in Lebanon, and there are events in Iraq, Jordan, and Syria. Similar demonstrations have taken place across the world, including in Nigeria, South Africa, and elsewhere. In Western nations like France, Sweden, Austria, Germany, the UK, and even the US and Canada, Quds Day has become an annual fixture. Zionist groups in the UK routinely smear the event as anti-Semitic. They're joined by the German-Israeli Friendship Society, which has smeared the Berlin demonstration. In Canada, Chutzday is denounced by the Zionist B'nai B'rith group, and in the US by the Zionist lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League. The hardline US-based neoconservative group, United Against Nuclear Iran, has condemned the event. Chutzday attracts strong negative attention from the Zionists and their supporters everywhere. Perhaps this is because of its militant character and support for resistance in Palestine. Unfortunately for them, Palestine has worldwide support, and the calls for solidarity with Palestine and indeed for the liberation of Palestine by the resistance will only grow stronger.
As you know, David, Chutzday gets a lot of criticism, I think, because it originated as a result of the Iranian Revolution. But do you think it has any wider significance other than drawing the inevitable opprobrium from the Zionists?
Yeah, it has significance because of its militant character, as the film there, I think, demonstrated. So it's a Palestine solidarity event which doesn't shirk from saying that we support the resistance in Palestine. And that, of course, is the only way that Palestine will be liberated. And so it's a kind of icon of the movement that people would be involved in supporting it. Yes, of course, it's attacked by the Zionist movement wherever it is celebrated. And that's a sign, really, that it is doing its job, that they are seeing it as a threat. They don't demonstrate against other sorts of pro-Palestinian activity. And so that's a key sign that Chutzday is really quite an important event and something which could be more significant in the years to come.
I mean, Chutzday is being marked internationally, isn't it, this year, and more widely, I think, than ever before. What would your advice be to supporters of Palestine liberation? How should they respond to these events that are taking place?
I think that the movement, Palestine Solidarity Movement, it's often called in the UK and other Western countries, needs to take its line really from the situation in Palestine. And that means celebrating and marking the importance of resistance inside Palestine against the Zionist entity, and indeed more widely against Zionism around the world. Zionist movements exist in Western countries all around the world as well. And it's important also then to not just to demonstrate in support of or in solidarity with Palestine, but also to think about how in the countries that people are in, that they start to think about dismantling the Zionist movement in the UK, in the US, in Canada, or wherever else they are.
Mm. I mean, what do you think people could do in this country in terms of, you know, supporting Palestinian resistance? I mean, you know, we hear about Palestine Action. I mean, what do you think Palestine, you know, resistance in this country should actually look like?
Well, Palestine Action is a good model. We've had them on this program before and discussed that issue. It's a good model. More people can, if they can get involved in that kind of thing, and there are many things you can do to support it, in addition to the kind of direct action, that's fantastic. Chutzday in this country is a demonstration. It could be a bigger demonstration. People should go along. It's on in a few days' time, on a Sunday, I think. So there's an important sense there. But I think also, I think this applies not just in the UK, in this country, but in other Western countries too, we should be looking to find ways to end the Zionist movement in this country as well as to stand in solidarity with the struggle of the resistance in Palestine. And that means dismantling Zionist organizations or encouraging them to become de-Zionized, that is, to revert to being Jewish organizations rather than pro-Israel organizations.
Mm. I mean, what do you think the focal point should be then? I mean, obviously you talk about Palestine Action. I mean, they're sort of targeting factories. I mean, there's that. I mean, should we be targeting the Israeli embassy as well? What's your thoughts?
The more we demonstrate against the Israeli embassy, the better. But there are also, of course, hundreds of Zionist organizations in this country. Some of them are charities, some of them are companies. These kinds of organizations need to be targeted too, not just factories that make arms, but the organizations which are sending money directly to the settlements in Palestine. These are the organizations which need to be pointed out, targeted, perhaps occupied, and in the end, shut down.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now because we've unfortunately run out of time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
April 25th happened to be the 42nd anniversary of the miracle in the desert of Tabas in east-central Iran that dashed all American hopes of superiority when the great Satan tried to launch a surprise attack on the nascent Islamic Republic through a well-planned operation codenamed Eagle Claw. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, The American Eagle Permanently Declawed. Here's the story. The forces of oppression, tyranny, atheism, polytheism, and all other vices that are opposed to the one and only Creator and the principle of divine justice are a vanishing lot and sooner or later will be a thing of the past, as was the case with the all evil powers. The U.S. regime claims to be world's paramount military power equipped with the largest number of nuclear weapons. It boasts of being the number one economy. It brags about its mastery of science and technology that enables it to explore outer space and control cyberspace. It gulls over its media stranglehold. And yet it is a helpless and impotent entity destined to be doomed, especially when it dares to confront those that are divinely blessed.